This program is dedicated to the memory of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, former United States Senator for the state of New York. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. Prescience is most simply defined as foresight. It can be considered the most distinguishing characteristic of the statesman. As an example of prescience, consider these words offered on the Senate floor in January 1980 by the then junior senator from the state of New York. "The Soviet Union," he said, "is seriously troubled, and even a sick society. The indices of economic decline are extraordinary. The indices of social disorder are even more so. The defining event of the decade might well be the breakup of the Soviet Empire." My guest today is the former senator from the state of New York, the Honorable Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Senator Moynihan, welcome to Dialogue.
A very warm welcome. You presented me with that citation. It was 1980. Nice subject. The indices that the Soviet Union was going to implode and just break up on its peripheries, that it wasn't, place wasn't working, that people didn't believe it anymore, in it anymore, were so powerful.
Right.
And yet official Washington, official London, New Delhi, couldn't comprehend it, couldn't get the least sense that this was how going to happen. It took them completely by surprise.
We're going to get into why it took them by surprise. The reason it didn't take you by surprise, though, I think owes a lot to hours profitably spent in the New York Public Library and in the company of Nathan Glaser and in your collaboration on Beyond the Melting Pot.
Well, thank you.
I think that's
right. Thank you indeed. How did you know that?
I read it.
Okay, all right.
It's the best way to know it. In fact, when you saw that ethnicity didn't happen, and I think as a direct quote, in New York City, did you get the notion it may be in trouble elsewhere?
When we saw that the melting pot,
right. happen. Ethnicity is what's happening, exactly.
The book was Beyond the Melting Pot. There was a musical comedy here from Britain called Beyond the Fringe.
Right.
I suddenly came up
with
that one. This is a bit of history, and thank you for remembering it. We were writing in an age when it was just assumed that social class was the defining aspect of a society, and the layers of class and class conflict and all would predict the future and define it. We weren't sure. Nat Glaser, whose idea this was, is a part of that old sort of left-leaning New York society. All our great neoconservatives come out of that age, that group. He had suspicions. I was raised more in a sort of Democratic Party politics, as it were, where you just assumed ethnicity.
Right.
And if we were suggesting that if ever there was a city where people would came from all over the world, they didn't have any roots there, they had no connections, they went to work in factories, whatever, if ever there was a place where class would be the defining quality of a person, it would be New York.
Right.
And it hadn't happened. Well, if it hadn't happened in New York, what about the rest of the world? We were talking about a large idea. We were rather tentative because the idea of class, the workers of the world, all that, the red flags, was so dominant in ideological circles and in sociological circles.
Exactly.
We thought it was otherwise, and I think a half century later, it looks good.
It does look awfully good, and as that idea is reflected in this wonderfully titled book, Pandemonium. That's the chamber of the devil, isn't it, Pandemonium?
That is hell.
Hell.
Where Satan sits on his throne. I think I ought to read it. It's from Milton.
Yes.
And it says, high on a throne of royal state, Satan exalted sat by merit raised to that bad eminence. And the idea that, you know, we're not moving into a blissful state of international harmony, you know, but troubles ahead, and there have been more, and there have been more, and more.
And these troubles, Senator, do I take it right that they flow from ethnicity run rampant, so to speak? Ethnicity allied with self-determination is an ideal which we'll get into in our conversation here. I mean, the kind of use of this identity in a way that has led the world from, I believe, 50 countries at the beginning of the 20th century to near on 200 now.
To near on 200, and counting.
And counting, and growing, right.
We argued that the when you have the suppressing forces of multinational empires, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the British Empire, things like that, when those forces were lifted, those pressures were lifted, up would come people saying, you know, I'm not a Austro-Hungarian, I'm a Hungarian, or I'm a Croat, or I'm a Serb, or I'm a Geg, or you're a Tosk. And our international affairs thinking and policy has been pretty slow to get on to this. I can tell you, not a secret, but it was at the time when the war in Kosovo had broken out, and we were wondering what is that, and where is that, and what is it all. We had a briefing was held for senators up on the fourth floor of the Capitol, a room that was originally housed the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. And there are no windows, so no spies can look in, and it's all soundproof and all that. And the principal officers of the federal government came to brief us, and our rule, a good one, is that you ask questions in order that you arrive.
Right.
And I had arrived fairly early for this, and so fairly early on it was my question. And we're talking about the Albanians. And I asked from this book, you see, I said, are they Gegs or are they Tosks? The ones in Kosovo.
Right.
Calling on. What? They're Albanians. Well, but there are two principal language groups in Albania. One is Geg, one is Tos. They're different language streams, they don't always get along. In any event, they're not the same peoples. Our State Department, our Defense Department had never heard of this. One of my colleagues just took, 50-50 chance, said Tosks. And the principals of our government said, that's right, Tosks. He later said very generously, Pat, you saved my ass, because I didn't say it.
It's a marvelous anecdote, but it's kind of troubling, too, because you have cited, as have others, that knowing these kinds of things, knowing the power of ethnicity, was to know the most powerful force in the 20th century, which went, I would say, largely unrecognized, did it not?
It did, much of it goes back. We are colleagues at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Much of it goes back to the Paris Peace Conference, right, and self-determination.
An idea that Wilson championed.
Wilson championed, and I think there's a little bit of a pattern here. Wilson didn't know anything about it, so I thought it was a good idea.
Right.
He had lived in a pretty rarefied, high Protestant world, and from Stoughton, Virginia, to Wesleyan, to Princeton, to the presidency.
Right.
Okay, his Secretary of State, a man named Robert Lansing, at this point, wrote kept a diary in Paris. He was very careful. He was an international lawyer. He comes from Watertown, New York, way up near the St. Lawrence. Same town that produced John Foster and John Foster Dulles and Mr. Lansing in between, three secretaries of state from a small place in upstate New York. He was very worried about self-determination. He said, do you know what you're setting loose
right,
here?
Right.
And he wrote it out very carefully. And I suggest that one of the things that he was sensitive, one of the reasons he was sensitive to this, he had been the Democratic County Chairman of Jefferson County up there. And to be a Democrat in upstate New York in those days meant you might have be an old New York family and have it carried on like that, but your voters were French Canadians,
right,
Canucks,
right,
Irishmen, Italians, people who worked in the sawmills and did the heavy lifting, and they didn't like the Anglos very much, and they didn't like each other very much, but they worked it out. They got along, but in a very special circumstances in which America has been able to accommodate these forces, and so much of the world has not.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I'm mindful also as we speak that, yes, indeed, Wilson did champion that notion, and as you just pointed out, Lansing was very much concerned about Wilson not understanding its further implications. But a group that may have understood them well for its own purposes was the Soviets, because it seems to me they appropriated this notion of ethnic self-determination based on ethnicity.
Oh, they did. They came to power saying all the ethnic groups of the Soviet, of the Russian, now Soviet, Soviet is a term for, you know, town council,
right,
meant to be, aren't we?
Writ large.
Everybody,
yeah.
Just good fellows. That had attractions. The Tsars weren't especially bad, but nor were they especially good about the conquest. They kept expanding that empire. And the Soviets, that red flag, the blood of all men is red, you see, so we're not going to have any of those things. And the minute they got into power, they clamped down and there was nothing.
Because, and perhaps I should phrase it as a question, was it because they wanted ethnic culture but not ethnic politics?
Exactly. An ethnic culture would stop at folk dancing. Nobody getting their own country, much less that. There's an interesting history to the melting pot as an idea. The book, our title, comes from a play, The Melting Pot, written by Israel Zangwill, a London playwright. Very respected in the company of Shaw and people like that. The play is set in Staten Island, in New York Harbor,
right,
and there's a young girl who is she's Jewish. She's the daughter of a Jewish a rabbi, I think, who was murdered in a pogrom that was led by a Tsarist general. And the young man is the son of that Tsarist general. Well, he wants to be a conductor, and she wants to be a violinist, something like that. And they fall in love, and they marry, and all those things from the other world, the old world, are forgotten. Mm. And in this new world, and Theodore Roosevelt was up in the balcony saying, "Bully, Mr. Zangwill, bully!" Well, about 5 years later, Mr. Zangwill decided he was a Zionist, and Jew and Gentile could never live together. He went off to the Middle East. The very man who thought it up melting pot became the one who said it can't happen. Now, both, you know, because there are ethnic groups, does not mean there can't be ethnic harmony.
Exactly, exactly.
But you have to work at it.
Don't you point out also that we may be guilty of misreading the history of the 19th century in Europe, for example, that there was perhaps substantially more ethnic harmony than we have tended to think there was?
It's not fashionable to say it, or wasn't. But there are worse places to have lived than in the Austro-Hungarian Empire of the 19th century.
Yes, this book has some first-hand accountings of scholars whose families and they themselves as youths had undergone that experience.
Right. I don't want to get onto sensitive ground, but the Indian subcontinent under the British Raj, there have been worse times.
Right.
And for many people, they have encountered them, haven't they?
Indeed. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons I think you wrote this book is that ethnicity as a force has to be understood. The first task is to understand it. But then it can be, if understood, and maybe this is what we're alluding to here, moderated. I mean, perhaps it's mutable. Perhaps there are things, and perhaps this society is specially constituted to do it, where you can make these things work well.
We have done what very few other nations have. We do get along. We know about each other. We know the color of your skin and the churches you go to and the jobs you have and the company you keep. But that is subsumed under a citizenship which we share. That wonderful motto of ours, and it's on the dollar bill, E Pluribus Unum.
Recipe for salad at one point.
Virgil, good for you. How do you know things
read
like
the
that?
Books,
oh, okay. Yeah. It was Virgil's describing a peasant with a pestle grinding up herbs, and it was on the cover page of something called Gentleman's Magazine in London, 18th century, and we picked it up out of many one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, you know what I liked about it, and the anecdote, I think we are a salad.
Yeah.
And a very good one at that. In the larger scheme of things, thinking about the world and loosing self-determination as an ideal upon it, we do get an enormous complexity, as the book points out, and as we've been talking about, when we can go from 50 to 200 and so forth, and have self-determination encouraged in our many of our most important documents, the UN charters, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the Atlantic Charter also in 1941 has some encouraging reference.
Watch out, Churchill would not have been enthusiastic
about it. Yeah, that's true too. But certainly the UN Charter, and in fact there's a longer distinguished lineage, our Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Human Rights. All these things conspire to make it a very noble ideal, but perhaps an untenable one.
Well, George, a look around the world, and what do you see but conflict on what Samuel Huntington calls the fault lines of civilizations? Just now, the fault line is Islam. If go to Moscow, where you just had a terrible experience with the Chechens,
who are
Muslims, and want their own state, and I would say, why not? Go to subcontinent, North India, Pakistan, both nuclear powers. About a year ago, they were that close to war. And that would be the first ever war between two nuclear powers. And it hasn't gone away. Go out to Western China and Xinjiang, and there are the same pressures. Iraq, I suppose, is such an encounter, although, and just boom, 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 boom. Sort of like the 8th century or the 9th century, these things, 1,000 years isn't long for these things. But, you know, even within an all-defining identity like Islam, ethnicity is very powerful.
Right.
Pakistan.
Yes, indeed, Pakistan.
I mean, it's just one ethnic group against another. All Islam, but you're a Sindh, and I'm an Afghan, and he's a Kashmiri, and the Punjab, and all those things. Fierce argument.
Indeed.
Look at Iraq. It's right there in that dividing line of Shia and Sunni. Well, part of the population is Sunni, the dominant part now. The Shias have a larger population.
60%.
That's right. All right. Yeah. All right. There you are. The Kurds. They're Muslim. And then there are some Chaldeans, which are Semitic. Christian, and boy, is that a mix and a mess. And although Mr. Aziz and his parishioners aside, they're all nominally Muslim. And Mr. Hussein is not an observant Muslim. Things can be very complicated, and try not to think they're simple, because that will catch you.
I think you're absolutely right. The complexity of this must not be overlooked. And because it must not be overlooked, and I guess this brings us to the concluding portion of our conversation, simply but very profoundly put perhaps, what is to be done? Do we need, perhaps in places like the United Nations, where so much of this began, has been encouraged, new notions of self-determination, what is acceptable, what should be discouraged, and perhaps new patterns of, to put it bluntly, intervention in states where these things are breaking out?
Yes. We now confront this phenomenon of the failed state, which almost invariably is a state where ethnic conflicts have just brought things to an awful demise. The sub-Saharan Africa would be a place like that, and not just there, all over. Ought there to be a mode of international intervention? Well, the French think so. Every time anything happens in sub-Saharan Africa in a former French colony, they just send troops.
Legion goes in, right.
They send troops. They don't certainly go to the Security Council, where they insist everybody else go, of course. We have accommodated to the idea of a state that reflects ethnic self-determination. But, sir, how many 100 square miles of earth are there where there's simply one ethnic group?
There you have it. It would be a world of Bantustans, wouldn't it?
Yeah. A world of Bantustans, and that didn't work. Mm-hmm. And this will sound presumptuous, but I could wish more people would look to us and say, how do they work it out? The Bureau of the Census now counts, I believe I have this number correct, 103 nationalities in the United States.
In the United States.
Yeah, 103. Hmm. Most of us couldn't count.
I was just thinking, don't ask me to do it. I couldn't do that at all.
But we get along. Yeah. We're always discovering things we didn't know. What was that? Detroit is the largest Islamic city.
Exactly.
And we have worked this out without necessarily intending it or knowing we were doing it. It has worked out. Nothing helps like prosperity.
Yes.
Enough things to go around. People are better, aren't they?
Well, quite frankly, this has been a theme of yours for quite some time, that the economic health and strength of the world would be a big ameliorative factor in all these things, in making people live together with more harmony. And next time we talk, we're going to talk about some of your experiences in India, but I think you're particularly keen on that.
Oh, I would like to do that. My wife, my daughter, we came to love India. They go back all the time. I go back when I can. And isn't India doing well?
Yes.
And if you don't think so, go to the operating room of an American hospital.
Oh, exactly.
See those surgeons, and thank heaven they're there.
Absolutely. Senator Moynihan, it's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you. I've looked forward to it for a long time, and I look forward to the ones we'll have in the future. May I ask in parting one thing that occurred to me as you spoke, and I don't want to be presumptuous either, but the power of the American experience and example in these kinds of questions. And it struck me that that may owe to the civic identity being emphasized here, and the fact that we have a kind of federalism based on the fact that we're Americans because we believe in an ideal that surpasses
the civic identity.
Civis,
Latin for community. And you're a citizen first, and you're an Irishman next, or Albanian, or you name it, there's one of them around. It has worked. Everybody has the vote. Not everybody votes, but they should.
Right.
And we have a national creed, which is equality and opportunity and responsibility. We sometimes forget that latter.
Right. Oh, well said. Well said indeed. You remind me of something Jim Billington said once, you know, that it's the pursuit of this ideal that can keep us from the pursuit of each other.
Well said, sir.
Well said indeed. Thank you, sir, for
next
being
time.
With us. Till next time. You have been listening to Dialogue. This program was dedicated to the memory of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, former United States Senator for the state of New York. The 24 years that Daniel Patrick Moynihan spent in the U.S. Senate were marked by his wit, eloquence, and prescience. He was also a founding father of our Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a pivotal presence in Washington's revitalization. For all these reasons, the Wilson Center Press is pleased to honor his memory through the republication of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, The Intellectual in Public Life, edited by Robert A. Katzman. To order this book, go to www.wilsoncenter.org.